Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. Tonight, we'll be continuing our exploration with a very special guest, a man who already once helped to transform spiritual practice in America and the West, the beloved spiritual teacher and deep human being who began his journey as Richard Alpert and is now known as Ram Dass. Terry Patton is a visionary behind this groundbreaking series and our host. Terry is a leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality, who supports, challenges, guides, and connects evolutionaries all over the world. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice, and his personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you, Paul. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Beyond Awakening. This series was begun, as you know, to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how our spirituality can play a catalytic role in helping us rise now to the challenges of our time and make this transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. We face enormous ecological and engineering challenges, but the cultural and spiritual challenges are probably even more fundamental and less widely understood. So that's our focus here. We've had a whole series of adventuresome, probing, and enlivening conversations in which we've focused on many specific aspects of this question. And tonight, I'm just overjoyed to be joined in conversation by Ram Dass in a dialogue entitled Being Love, Right Here, Right Now. Ram Dass is one of America's most beloved teachers of a universal spirituality. He sparked a revolution 40 years ago with the publication of Be Here Now, this landmark classic, which he has articulated with an amazingly soulful example, inspired my generation to see the world in a whole different light. And over the past four decades, Ram Dass has been an inspiration and a catalyst for seekers worldwide, challenging people everywhere to find new sources of meaning and purpose. I first found out about him back in the 60s when I heard about two renegade Harvard psychologists, Richard Alpert and Timothy Leary, who had tried LSD and had it opened their minds, and they felt that it could spark a revolution in consciousness, and the psychedelic revolution kind of unfolded from there. And then later I read about his profound encounters with his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, after which he helped to lead what was for me the much more important revolution, the decision to try to get high without drugs through meditation and Eastern sciences of mystical transformation, a high from which we would never have to come down. This revolution matured into an exploration of spiritual service. And Ram Dass wrote a book called How Can I Help that kind of epitomized that. This process helped give birth to the whole culture of spirituality and service that we're engaging and extending on this very teleseries. Almost 14 years ago, like many millions of others, I was shocked and upset to hear about his near-fatal stroke. And then later, deeply touched by the reawakening brought on by that ordeal and his recovery, as it was chronicled in the award-winning film, Fierce Grace. Ram Dass has always shared his life experiences authentically and transparently while offering a wealth of timeless teachings on awakening, service, love, and the path of the heart. He's been one of the key people who has helped lay the ground for the whole conversation that we're having now. And this opportunity to talk with him coincides not only with the 40th anniversary of the publication of Be Here Now, but a new book by Ram Dass entitled Be Love Now, which is a deeply personal and wonderfully universal book that guides you through the pitfalls and perils of your own spiritual path, recognizing the whole thing, beginning to end, inside out, top to bottom, as a matter of love, first, last, and always. Speaking personally, I just want to say thank you, Ram Dass, for being here now with me and all of us across four decades of spiritual practice and inquiry. And thank you especially for being right here, right now with us in this conversation as we peer forward into the future of spiritual practice. It's a tremendous honor and a delight to have you with us. I'm so grateful that you're
here.
Thank you,
Terry. Thank you, Terry.
As you know, many of our friends are afraid that we're in a real tremendous crisis right now, and that it's going to take a cultural revolution for us to meet that. Do you have any opening thoughts about how our spiritual practice right now is perhaps evolving or changing or shifting so that we can come together in a new way to rise to that challenge?
Well, I think it's to come together actually doesn't do it. It's more like be together. I don't think people are... I don't think we are doing very well in large groups and large external groups. When each of us in our insides turn to what is inside, that brings us together. For example, we all have peace in our hearts. It seems silly yell for it out there. We have it inside. And when we have that inside, we radiate it. We radiate peace. And that's the way we get peace in the world. It's individual by individual by individual. And it's individual in relation to God. I remember being at a peace rally at Boulder, at the factory that made bombs. And Allen Ginsberg told me to come. And I was sitting with about 40 or 50 people in meditation out in the grass by the railroad tracks there. And there was a stage, and Caldicott, the doctor from
Australia, Helen Caldicott.
Yeah, and she was up speaking, and she was, "Peace, we want peace, peace." And from where I was sitting, that wasn't the way to do it. That wasn't the way to do it, because we need the peace from our hearts, and just a few of us, the peace in our hearts, that will influence many. Yeah, I mean, I can feel love in my heart. And I start walking around the streets, and now I roll the streets, but I look at people's eyes, and I look at them as souls, and we make contact, and we both go deeper in our spiritual lives by meeting that way.
There's a deep paradox in these kinds of questions that we're asking, because in some sense our spirituality is in our own hearts, and we arrive at that through our own inner practice. And yet, I know a lot of us feel, as you also do, and you know, in your history, you know, this impulse to serve and to make a difference, to address the systemic patterns in our world, as we serve, not only to be kind to the person we can see right here, but also to somehow address some of these larger patterns and systems that seem to often be so destructive.
Well,
I wonder if you'd like to, yeah.
Well, it's not going to be done with the mind. And no matter how awesome the problem, the fear is not the way to go. And when I go inside to my heart, I don't hear the problems. I hear the solutions. And being with the problems in the mind is nothing, doesn't solve the problems. I see that our ego, which up here in the mind is built on fear. But down here, the real self is built on love, because it rises from the Atman. And if your perception, the root of your perception is love, the problems seem very mind manufactured. Also, I think that surrender to a higher consciousness is a way, because you look at all of the darks and lights of society, and you feel you don't have anything to do with that, and you your mind can't even comprehend why are those there, why are those there. And you are, when you open up to the One, you truly surrender to that One, you realize that the One has its manifestations in dark and light. And I can't see that our minds aren't going to equal the mind that creates, the creative mind that makes the trees and the ocean and our bodies and our thoughts. And then we may be very little scratches on the wall with our intellect. Now, when I surrender, I feel trust and faith that the world is going just wonderfully. And I know it's not wonderful to my mind, but I can feel it's going wonderfully. Having been with my guru and people of that nature and souls of that nature, I have trust that there is consciousness running running our world. There's a story I tell. It's a rather long story, but when I left India the first time, my guru invited me to come back in two years, and he'd be waiting for me. And so 2 years came by, and I went into India, and I couldn't find him. Looked all the little places, little villages. So I went to a meditation class, a Vipassana meditation class, and there were about 60 people of them, in the 60 meditators, and I by the I think it was around the halfway through of the meditation course, it was a 20 day or something like that. And I decided I didn't want to work. I didn't want to meditate. I'd go out and look for my guru. I'm spending all my time, instead of watching my breath, where is he going? Where? At tea break, I talked to the girl on the next zafu, and I said I was going to do that. She said, "Oh, I'd love to go and look for your guru. And I have a friend who has a bus that goes from England to India. What he does, puts under the floorboards, I don't know, but we'll get him to go, and we'll go in the bus to go for your, looking for a girl." So when we time to go, there were 24 of us going of the 60. And word had spread. And we started out to Delhi, which is where there was ice cream and soft beds and all those things after the meditation course. And so we were going straight to Delhi, and Danny Goleman was in the bus, and he came by, and he said, "You know, why don't ride, we can take a right up there, and that'll be over in Allahabad, and it's really a very sacred city." So I could, this is 10 in the morning, 10 in the morning. And I said, "Well, we'll try to decide. I'll either go straight or go right. I don't know. But I'll think about it. I'm going to decide about it." Well, we're all spiritual seekers. We could go to the right, but that ice cream was awful good. And we went, and finally the bus driver said, "Do you want to go right or do you want to go left?" I said, "Well, I'll make the decision." And I said, "Go right." And we go to Allahabad. Allahabad is a big, empty, it's like a fairground. It looks like the fair has gone, you know, but and a couple of people, a little walking, some dogs. And so I said, "Well, we've hit the sacred space, and we'll these bus starts across, and Ramesh Wadas, who's in the back of the bus, says, there's Maharaji, my guru. And Maharaji is walking with a man right by the bus. And I, of course, say, well, look, why don't we all stop and touch his feet? And we stop, and we all tumble out and touch his feet. And he doesn't seem the least bit surprised. And then he says, follow us. They had a rickshaw. As the rickshaw through the streets and big bus behind the rickshaw. Didn't know where, but he just said, follow us. And we came to the man's house. And the bus pulled up, and the man's wife came down, and she says, we've been waiting for you. And then she said, Maharaji woke us up at 6 in the morning and said, get up and make food for 25 people. That's the including the bus driver. At 6 o'clock, and I had, at 10 o'clock, I was deciding. I thought, what kind of deciding is that? It was already decided. And nowadays, when I get something that I've got to decide, I surrender. I surrender.
Well, thank you for that beautiful story. That was gorgeous. And it leaves me reflecting on my own depth of surrender as I engage life's myriad apparent decisions. I think that it always can be valuable to deepen into that sense of how profoundly we co-create, how profoundly our world is flowing through us, and how often our choices might just be apparent. And yet if I don't feel a sense of responsibility to participate and to do my best, to act as if my decision had impact and bring care to the consequences of my decision, I feel less aligned somehow with God and with love. That if I can bring love to my choosing and bring a care for something greater than myself to my choices and choice making, that does feel aligned. Somehow I feel, oh, that there's a kind of profound both and to this surrender and responsibility.
Yeah, I think that is surrender and responsibility. The story reminds me that we're all being taken care of, and it involves our actions. If I hadn't decided the bus, I would have gotten the ice cream, but I wouldn't have gotten the
darshan.
Darshan.
Yeah. So it's sort of a decoding of our fear-based, mind-based, ego-based decision-making that gets in the way of a larger flow from a more heart-based, love-based, co-creative choosing that is our way of letting thy will be done through my own.
That's it. That's exactly right. Exactly right. Exactly right.
So you're counseling then that conveying a kind of heartfelt trust and a deep trust of being and of the grace of being to our perception of existence, even as we see apparently terrible mistakes being made that seem like they have consequences in the suffering of many people or even the deaths of many people, so that we don't engage on the basis of a presumption of problem and dilemma and anxiety and bring our efforts to make a contribution out of that problem consciousness.
Yeah, and you said even death. Now that's a big thing for us, but it isn't a big thing for Maharaji, and it isn't a big thing for my soul, because I've done it as a soul, done many and many and many deaths before, because I have faith in reincarnation, and therefore the people whose deaths have been in the tsunami, I can still see these people finishing with one incarnation and working towards another one. And this was their method of death in this incarnation. And because there were many of them, we'll ring the bell. So many souls will go on to the next incarnation. I'm just trying to frame the issue of death.
You know, it's interesting. I float through a lot of different environments of cultural agreement, and in some of those environments, this heartfelt trust of the goodness and beauty and truth of existence is really up front. But in some of the environments of some of the people that feel to me like they really are profoundly committed good people who are really giving themselves over to something beyond themselves, there's an increasing mood of upset as they see the climate change treaties not getting made and the changes of behaviors and the melting of polar ice caps and all the rest. There's this tremendous sense of we need to rise up with a different kind of choosing. Even Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev, who I interviewed earlier in this series, was offering the opinion that unless world leaders who have consequential impact are drawn to a bigger view, he thinks that there will be a kind of pruning of the human population in a way that, you know, none of us would like to see, I think. And so this, there are some environments of social activists wherein a lot of people are drawing lines of agreement, feeling that we're passing a terrible point of no return, and that a different kind of urgency is necessary. And I find that in my own heart, I'm feeling a sense of joy as I commit myself to being of service to what is greater than myself, and to maybe coming together with other people of good heart and care in a different level of intimacy and a different level of commitment to what's greater than ourselves. And this does feel spiritual. I don't feel that it necessarily has to be rooted in a unenlightened and grim and mind-based and fear-based orientation, that there is room perhaps for some kind of cultural renewal that has some new features that might be evolving in a way that that does have some newness, even though the fundamental resource that it draws on is eternal and has been here forever.
The way the increasing virulence of the environment is a matter we can all feel bad about, but I can often see that it is waking up people to do something, and good people are, oh boy, this is hard to say, that good people are getting depressed because their goodness is not doing anything. Because every time I think of good and bad, the two are under the one. And the one is taking our dark and light and bringing about change. And we are very frightened of change. Death being the change that is most frightening. And maybe we are going to a new type of world when the warming comes down. I don't mean to be, there's a place where you surrender and you act. And you act out of goodness and act out of caring. I'm a follower of Hanuman. Hanuman is a monkey. He's a symbol of service as a way of being with God. And there's a great line, whose Ram is the God, and Ram says to Hanuman, "Who are you, monkey?" And when Hanuman answers, "When I don't know who I am, I serve you. When I don't do who I am, I am you." Two perceptions. And I think if we do our roles in life and do them dharmically, we will play our part to serving God and serving our world.
So when we don't know who we are, we serve God, and maybe in the form of one another and the world and even the climate or the environment or other justice or compassion in whatever ways.
That's the right.
And when we do know who we are, we stand in that freedom and probably still serve. Maybe the activities are no different.
Yes, maybe the same thing.
Yeah. So this isn't really so much a contradiction of the impulse to activism, but a profound reminder that to the degree that we get drawn into the mood of problem or dilemma, if we are in an urgency that is anxiety-based rather than fundamentally born of that darshan, of the beloved always before us,
love. Yeah, I can love my fellow human beings, and yet I will do my part to make sure terrorists don't go to terrorize people.
You know, one of the ideas that's been circulating through the conversations I've been having with people over this last couple of months as a part of this series, has been the idea that as human societies have grown more complex, the kind of mind that it takes to see clearly has had also to get more nuanced and more able to see, you know, just more complexity, more patterns. And that things that are confronting us now are often we're in over our heads, that we're confronting a reality that is so fast moving and so complex that often our gut sense of it is not quite nuanced enough to capture what we're really confronting. And that therefore there's a heart reason to try to see more clearly and even to use the mind to be more adequate to the complexity that we confront so that we can be creative participants, so that we can be adequate to what we're confronting, so that we can comprehend what is really here and not oversimplify it into something it's not. And therefore this wonderfully essential distinction that you've made between love and mind, between heart and head, between dilemma and joy and the connectedness of seeing the beloved, sometimes might have an expression of my love is pressing me to see more clearly. My love is pressing me to care and to find a way to make a difference in this very, very confusingly complex situation. How can I love here? How can I make a contribution here that matters? That even staying in that loving disposition, I'm pressing into the complexity nonetheless.
Yeah. That seems like a response that a mind would make, not a heart. A heart will say, I look out at the trees and I think, that is a complex thing. And I love the tree, and I will be loving with the tree, but I don't understand all the treeness. And when I do love that tree, I will become that tree, and then will subjectively know that tree, but not objectively. Am I making...
Yes. A sympathetic identification that's felt.
Yeah. You know, it seems to me that the mind is a... It's a siddhi. It's a power we have, and I think we often we play with the siddhi,
and it's and become distracted from the beloved by the dance of our minds.
That's exactly right. And I As a soul, I am loving awareness, and I'm aware the river of thoughts come out of my mind. And in the past, I used to identify with my thoughts. Now I merely notice them. And notice them, that one's coming out of fear. I'll love them, each one, even their fearful ones.
So that in a way this whole process of the speeding up of of people's lives and attention with the constant interruptions that are part of the pace of 21st century living.
Yeah.
Is tending to feed that distraction and maybe make it more apparent. Maybe there's something that's being served. I don't know.
Maybe. We're in a mind environment.
Mm-hmm.
You and I both know that the loving heart of spirit is not something to be using words about.
Mm.
And that's what I do. I try to explain those things, and I know how futile that is, except that it points the way.
Mm.
Points the way. And I'd rather live in the loving void than in the complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in both of them.
It's a choice then in each moment to notice that open-hearted immediacy that is before us, the beloved, it's the difference between seeing that one and knowing about the fact of that one.
Yeah.
Being here with you, beloved, seeing you, beloved, here, now, before me.
That's it.
Thank you. Touched by you. Seeing you, grateful.
Yeah.
Dropping anything that would distract me from your gorgeous eyes.
I like to live in the yum, 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 yum world.
That's
but
great.
I don't feel that I'm hiding my head from the things of the world. I think I can contribute love and peace. Like I think of these sadhus in the mountains in the Himalayas, and they never leave their cave, and they are contributing to the vibration of the world just as much as Obama is.
And in returning us again and again, more persistently, first, last, always, top to bottom, beginning to end, to love, to relaxing whatever it is that clenches that heart or distracts that heart.
That's right. That's right.
Well, it's gorgeous to be here in this space with you and in the one we am seeing himself in these glittering, sparking moments between birth and death that keep re-arising in the laughter.
Now that I'm old, contentment is very much with me. Contentment. And I was just last week with a contemporary who's a year, he was born a year after me, is Dan Ellsbury.
Oh, yeah.
And I was afraid to speak about contentment because he views the world a scary world. Scary world. And we've got to do something. And I don't think my contentment fills the bill.
But your life having, you know, you've turned right a lot of times over this last 40 or 50 years, and you've turned right toward love, toward the beloved, toward the guru, toward the darshan in a lot of different ways, a lot of different times. And those of us have been making some of those same right turns and who feel a kind of loving appreciation to you as an older brother, or for some, a father or a grandfather figure.
An uncle.
Yeah. You know, that there's something to be learned about how you're feeling it. And it sounds like there's a way that those right turns put a kind of money in the contentment bank.
Yeah.
You know, part of what I am hoping that I'm serving through this series and other work that I do is a continued renewal and evolution of and deepening and broadening of spiritual practice. And the process of spiritual practice itself evolving, you know, is a big focus of this conversation.
Yeah.
And you really, in a very unique way, just completely different from anybody else on the series, you personally participated in that cultural transformation of the 60s and 70s, particularly the spiritual culture that we're, you know, so many of the people who spent a decade or two or three or four as serious practitioners began the process influenced by you, or at least feeling you as an accompanying spirit who understood the things that were drawing them in the directions they chose. And you've had a personal impact, personally participating in a way where you were a focus even of media attention, and your choices got, you know, communicated via books and all kinds of things, you know, magazines, movies, news reports, all kinds of things, so that they affected people. And you had the experience as if you were participating in the evolution of spiritual practice in the West, like your journey became part of a process that a lot of people shared. And as we are in a moment when we hope that there will be another turning of the Dharma wheel, that there will be a broadening and a deepening and a coming together, and that will take things to another octave, that it will be, you know, things will only be, things will be the same as they always were, except even more so, you know, that the eternal will show up as never before. That which never changes can show up in a way it never has before, something like that. I mean, we do aspire to have that, to be of service in some way that really helps. And I wonder if from this unique perspective, there are other things that come to mind to share.
Well, my book, Be Love Now, which we just put out with Rameshwar Das. It shows how Maharaji a love, unconditional love. The unconditional love worked for me in what I, how he turned me. He turned me. I was going to New York 2 days from the first I met him. And I didn't leave India in 6 months. Something and nothing happened. World couldn't. Something happened to me. To change my direction. And when I found, when I realized that this love was, all I could say was, I'm home, I'm home, I'm home. Home in the heart. And most people in their lives would savor that place. If we could all go home in our hearts, boy, it would be so beautiful. And I see satsangs that are so rich and warm and loving. Boy, wouldn't that be lovely? Wouldn't that be the world? The world would be a satsang. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yum, yum, yum.
That's beautiful. I think sometimes that it has been my experience in dropping into that, into satsang in the most profound way, that satsang never began and that it never ends, and that I only need to be reminded that I'm always already in satsang.
Yes.
That the hall is wherever I'm looking.
But satsang is in the moment, and the moment is beyond time and beyond space. So it's, the moment is eternal.
Mm.
And that's what you, well, we as souls, we are eternal. We are eternal. And that's only our minds got crapped up a lot of time and space.
Mm. Thank you so much, Ram Dass. This has been just utterly delightful and heartful and deep and rich and full of the love that you are being right now. Really lovely to spend this time with you.
Well, that's because you're listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Beautiful.